From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Joey Valley.
We are from Hayward.
We're from the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, why 5 to 10,000 eucalyptus trees might be cut from the Oakland Hills.
Those burning embers will get down there and actually start what we call spot fires, basically jumping across the landscape.
Then we hear one comedian's recipe for making culturally relevant humor.
Ideally, you can mix your social consciousness and your poop jokes.
And we find out the answer to this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
This city's fresher than fresh, district exciting. In the city, thanks to Mayor Lee, it's fresher than fresh.
Fresher than fresh, today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The recent fire in Lake County demonstrated just how quickly disaster can ignite on our dry California landscape.
Tens of thousands of acres overtaken by flames in less than 24 hours. The Rocky Fire in Lake County, now at 47,000 acres, is now almost half the size of Clear Lake itself.
Here in the densely populated Bay Area, we're no less vulnerable. The 1991 fire in the Oakland Hills took out more buildings than any fire in state history. Since then, local agencies have been trying to compromise on a fire mitigation strategy to keep the costly disaster from recurring. Decades later, we're close to finalizing that plan. Among other things, it involves cutting down 5 to 10,000 highly flammable eucalyptus trees. But many people want the trees to stay, and there have been several lawsuits and protests to keep them in place. KALW's Liza Veal went to sort out the controversy.
For years, I've been running up the Wildcat Canyon Trail in Berkeley. My dad takes the dog up there every single morning. On the hill, the eucalyptus trees loom and they creak. You're subsumed by the smell of camphor and the fog. Up close, the bark is opalescent pink and blue. These forests cluster all over the Berkeley and Oakland Hills now, but there's a plan to thin them down. My dad's stance on the debate pretty much begins and ends with,
"You don't cut down trees, period."
Right, come on.
I tend to agree, but I wasn't there for the fire in 1991, the one that started in the Oakland Hills just south of where I run.
We walked in that place for a week after the 91 fire. It was just incredibly sad.
And I'm not a scientist, so I talked to one.
How many places were burned up and essentially destroyed, all happening in one day?
Scott Stevens is a professor of fire science in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. He says, on an average day, most days of the year, eucalyptus is not a problem. But when the right conditions come together at the same time...
You get an east wind at 90 degrees coming down with humidities below 20, then you got a problem.
And the trees up high in the hills, they make the fire spread faster and farther.
The ones on the ridges are tough because those are the ones when they burn, they can throw embers a mile downwind.
Yeah, so let's back up. Before the eucalyptus starts throwing embers to the wind, the fire begins on the ground, the understory. Eucalyptus shed big strips of bark. You know, they have that shaggy look. So the ground beneath them is littered with scraps, fluffy piles of kindling. And the flames down there get so big, they lick at the top of the canopy, up where the leaves are. And because there's so much oil on those leaves, the trees torch, they ignite.
You could easily have flames maybe 60, 70, 80 feet, 100 feet long.
The Australians call them gasoline trees. And the burning scraps are the perfect shape for flying, like wings. So when the wind comes, they take off with enough oil to keep them burning until they land downhill.
Those burning embers will get down there and actually start what we call spot fires, new fires. It's like this, it's basically jumping across the landscape. So it's not moving as a wave, it's moving by jumping. That's exactly what happened to the 91 fire.
Not everyone agrees with that story. At a protest in Berkeley, people have a lot of reasons for wanting to save the eucalyptus. Some hold up signs that are anti-Monsanto and Dow, the two big agricultural businesses that sell herbicide, the same kind that would be hand-painted on eucalyptus stumps to prevent regrowth. Activists point out that the U.S. government buys $1 billion worth of herbicide from Monsanto every year. But not all the protesters here think that big agriculture money is behind the plan to chop the trees.
Honestly, I'm not so cynical to think that that's really what's driving it. I really think it's ideology that's driving the plan to cut so many trees down.
Jack Gashite is organizing to save the trees. The ideology he's talking about is the one that values native species over newer species. He says those values are not always rational.
This romantic notion we should go back to just oaks and bays on the hillsides with a few grasses, it doesn't make any fire sense. It doesn't make any ecological sense. It's exactly the opposite of what we want. We should have more trees.
This native versus non-native species argument goes way back. You see, a lot of people think the eucalyptus were never supposed to be here. Before the 1900s, there weren't many trees on these hills, just some oak and bay. Then a group of Berkeley professors started importing all kinds of non-native trees. They liked the idea of an urban forest, and real estate people found that planting them in the neighborhoods lured more homeowners. The eucalyptus has its own story. The ones in the East Bay Hills were brought from Australia for a lumber business, but turned out eucalyptus makes crappy wood, so the trees were never harvested, they just spread. They edged out the other species competing for the land, which is what people mean when they call them invasive. But on both sides of this debate, one thing both activist Gashite and Professor Stevens agree upon is that there is no one right, pure environment for these hills. Again, Scott Stevens.
We've changed ecosystems so much in this country.
He took it back even further in time. Says there were hundreds of years when the Native Americans were burning all the plants that grew on the hills in order to make room for a certain grass that flourished from the ashes. The seeds in that grass were a staple crop of theirs. But that grassland is gone. The grasses we have now
that are right here in the East Bay are at least 80% invasive species that came over from the Spanish when they came here into California 300 years ago.
So we can't realistically return the land to the way it was before. All we can do is figure out what's most beneficial for the land that we can control.
You don't want to go after every endangered species just because it's an endangered species, or you don't want to go after every species that basically takes over a site and thinking that it's always evil. The new species could provide ecosystem services. So I think you look at it one thing at a time.
These days, when I run in the hills, I'm more captivated by the eucalyptus. In the morning, the rest of the hill begins to scorch from the sun, but I look at them and they're glistening with wetness. It's because the eucalyptus collect moisture from the fog. I head underneath the canopy. It sounds like it's lightly raining. But it's not enough moisture to make the area fireproof. Many of these plants are fire dependent, but we've been preventing fires here for 150 years. The fuel is just building up. So now, when I look around, I see a hillside that's been waiting for over a century to do what it wants to do every several months. Burn. For Cross Currents, I'm Liza Veal.
So what do you think? Should the eucalyptus trees be cut down or not? Leave us a message on our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and you may hear yourself on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Comedian and event organizer George Chen has been doing comedy for a few short years, but he's been involved with the arts in San Francisco for many more. He talked to KALW's Jen Chien about his path to comedy.
You were a musician for a long time. How did you get into comedy?
Yeah, I had always been interested in both things. I was invited by a friend who is also a musician to do like the spoken word night. So I did something at her spoken word night, and that was kind of my first foray into doing it. Also, I had done a musical that a friend of mine had written called Jurassic Park 4, long before Jurassic World came out, and sort of a fan fiction take on Jurassic Park as a musical.
Fan fiction musical.
Fan fiction musical, and I was the Jeff Goldblum character, Dr. Ian Malcolm. So that was my first kind of being on stage, not playing music, and getting laughs for just talking as Jeff Goldblum.
What was your internal feeling when you realized what it was like to be on stage and make people laugh?
In a theatrical kind of situation and getting laughs off of that, it just felt like people looked at me differently afterwards, and I think I liked that part of it.
How did they look at you?
I just, like, they were like, oh, you're like, your little bit of Jeff Goldblum magic is coming through you. That was, it was just a different feeling to get the immediate response from a live audience. Whereas I think in bands, like, you can, if you're in a band that where people know the words and sing along, you've got a completely different experience than I did. We never had that kind of thing happen with our bands.
So in addition to performing comedy, you also host comedy shows?
My show, The Cynic Cave, I run every Saturday, and there's four producers that work on the show there.
On a broad, I guess on a national level, stand-up comedy and kind of comedy in general is like the province of white dudes. And that's changing gradually. The Bay's own Kamau Bell had his own TV show, then it got canceled. Mm-hmm. How do you think about programming your comedy shows? Do you think about quote-unquote diversity? Is that a value that you try to bring forward?
I do think about diversity in booking. By default, since I'm there, there's at least one person of color on the bill. And now I run the show on Saturdays with three other producers, Allison Mick, Natasha Muse, in Nato Green, so there's at least two people of color and gender
women.
Diversity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. In my mind, that sort of bakes it in to the equation. But I am also aware of, like, giving chances to not only underrepresented demographics of women and minorities, but also underrepresented demographics of, like, just new comedians. Because if I was only going off people that had been doing comedy for like 5 or 6 years, the pool is more limited in the Bay Area. So there's like a couple of angles that I try to come at it.
What about your audiences?
I haven't really kept a solid tab on it. I think like what I notice more is when, well, Nato has a lot of jokes where he's like, well, we should do this to rich people. And then some of the audience tightens up and it's like, okay, these are like probably techies. Then some audiences love it. So it's sort of this weird mix of, I can see ethnic and gender diversity. I can't necessarily see like class diversity, but that does come in there also.
So we do have a clip of you at the Punchline telling a joke about Sarah Slocum, who is the woman who had the Google Glass knocked off of her face at a bar.
Yeah.
Let's take a listen to that.
But maybe she's right, guys. Maybe techies should be a protected class of citizen. Because like maybe like we're going to look up back on this in 20 years and be like, this was the first hate crime against the cyborgs. Like, in the history books. There's not gonna be books in the future, guys. History PDFs or whatever. It's gonna be like, Sarah Slocum, she was the Rosa Parks of the Google Glass. When they came for the Google bus, I said nothing. Because I did not ride the Google bus. When they came for the Google Glass, I said nothing because I could not afford the Google Glass. When they came for the Segways, this is really fun if you're riding a Segway before you guys go.
I'm speaking with comedian and event producer George Chen. Given that there are these divides that are kind of opening up in the city, mm-hmm. in the Bay, really, how did you think about writing a joke about this?
First, the incident, which I found hilarious, and then her rationale behind why she needed to be protected more than anyone else and how she was trying to turn into like, oh, I had a hate crime done on me. And like, that is the part that I think is rife for parody. It's just like, yeah, okay, let's take that logic to its extreme. Like, you're like this freedom fighter for this technology that only certain rich people can afford.
Do you feel like comedy in some way can help heal some of the divides that are opening up between techies and non-techies, or people the culture that's newer to San Francisco?
I don't know exactly how one heals that cultural divide. It seems like a little too fresh of a wound to be healed at the moment. We're getting into a very like a Hong Kong kind of situation where it's just like extreme poverty, extreme wealth, like living like right side by side. And that's like if you walk through, you know, walk down Market Street, you're going to get all of that. Can comedy, I don't know. Comedy, I think, can change people's minds about issues, but it's at the same time, if those people like wanted to become politicians, they'd become politicians. You know, there's sort of like a difference, I think, between people that are just, I want to point out what's wrong, but I'm not necessarily going to be the one that fix what's wrong. What comedians are always good at is identifying what is wrong. Like your logic has hypocrisy in it, or this is just something that violates its own logic. And I think that's what comedians are good at identifying. They're not necessarily going to be
making policy,
making actual, they'll just maybe can be society's conscience in a certain way. And it can be towards that, or it can just be like a poop joke. Ideally, you can mix your social consciousness and your poop jokes, which in San Francisco, I think there's a lot of opportunities to do that.
That was comedian George Chen speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. He hosts a weekly comedy show at Lost Weekend Video in San Francisco's Mission District. More information is at KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Good afternoon, President Hsu and supervisors. I was reading in the paper, they're looking for fresh air in the city, and I thought that'd be perfect because we need a city that's fresher than fresh. Exciting, it's so exciting to we. This city's fresher than fresh, district exciting. In the city, thanks to Mayor Lee, it's fresher than fresh.
We asked you what that was and where you think we recorded it. KALW's Ashley Ann Krigbaum headed over to San Francisco City Hall to bring us the story behind the sound.
Next speaker. My name is Charles Malone Sonson Jr. I'm a member of Local 34 Power Driver and Bridge Builder, also Local 22. I'm trying to find out what is the problem with the Transb Terminal. It's supposed
I'm John Avalos, and I'm a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. During the public comment section of the meeting, there's all kinds of people who present to us and give testimony on whatever is, you know, on their minds. Sometimes it's something really horrifying that needs attention from the government and from the city, and other times it's people who have just a joke to tell or a Hank Williams lyric to recite. That's happened a couple times. This one guy, Walter, sings the songs.
Next speaker, please.
Good afternoon, President Hsu and supervisors. I was reading in the paper, they're looking for fresh air in the city.
Yeah, my name is Walter Paulson. I'm the City Hall crooner, they call me, but I'm the City Hall singer. And I've been singing here at City Hall for about 8 years at least. Yeah, maybe more. 8.5 years, maybe.
Fresh, district exciting. In the city, thanks to Mayor Lee, it's fresher than fresh. And about the police, about the fire chief, Joanne Hayes White. You know, you can't start a fire without a spark. This fire chief's for hire.
Do you think that the public comment section of the meetings is important for the city?
I think it is because people need to voice their opinions about things, and the supervisor wants to hear the opinions of people. Sometimes it's not as good as people would like, but they hear the good and the bad together, and they want to hear what's going on in the city anyway. so they need to know. Sometimes I'll look at the agenda to see, you know, so I could plan the song in my own mind. I like to write the song. Sometimes I'll change it. I told people during the meeting, while they're talking about the item, I'll say, no, that song's not so good. I think I'll change that, and I'll change the words. And sometimes it came out really good because of that, but other times it didn't. But sometimes it came out of nothing. You know, all of a sudden you had to do it real quick, and it still came out the best of all. Like one of the hits I had was about, we talked about the declawing of cats, and they really liked it and recorded it. Pussycat, I love you. You and your pussycat eyes. You and your pussycat nose. You and your pussycat claws. You know, it was about the declawing of cats. So that came out a big hit, yeah.
Next speaker, please.
This is entitled Let's Clean Up Our Act. Here's the goal.
You know, we'll be at these long meetings. 2 hours of tense discussion and public comment that is counterposed to each other, people are angry, and then Walter will come in and sing a song. And sometimes he's so needed, you know, to just to be able to have some other perspective in the room where we don't take ourselves so seriously, and there's an element of humor and humanness in there, and Walter brings that.
Why do you think that you've been doing this for so long, coming in and singing the comments in these meetings? Like, what is it that really propels you? Do you love about it?
Well, I like to sing, and I also like to put the lyrics together, which is good. And I know the supervisors and even the mayor and the supervisors seem to like it. And plus, I haven't done it for a few times, people out on the street or where the YMCA or wherever I go, they say, oh, I like seeing that. And, you know, even especially when I haven't done it, they say, oh, I like what you do at City Hall. It's such a change. It brings different, you know, it's like a break, you know.
Have you gotten any other positive response from supervisors over the years?
Yes, I have. I've heard that even the president of the board said, President Hsu said, never stop singing, he says.
I also saw a video. Did Chris Daly sing to you once before he left the board?
Yeah, we did a duet, and he sat in his seat, and I sang at the podium, and we sang, sing us a song, you're the piano man.
It's 2 o'clock on a Tuesday. The regular crowd shuffles in. Combos and Avalos are standing next to me, hoping your legislation will win.
What is it about singing that you really enjoy? Like, is there particular things, like why you're drawn to singing? Like why you and your personality and why you love it?
Because it gives a good spirit to things, and it gives you the good feeling inside, you know, like always keep going, never stop trying, you know what I mean? Always try hard. Like, don't stop believing, keep going now.
I hope you had a nice city September. Hope you had a city great month, and I'll see you in October, and I'm gonna wish you city luck.
Thanks, boss. Next speaker.
Thanks, Walter. Our winner this week is Fran Culp. Congratulations, Fran. We're gonna send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, you'll have another chance to win next week. Here's your sneak listen.
G. Giving, garlic in our garden. A, acceptance, aromatic garlic aioli. R, relaxed, roasted garlic. L, love, loaves of garlic bread. I, independence, infused garlic ice cream. C, commitment, crushed garlic.
We'll tell you the story behind the sound next Thursday on Cross Currents. To find out more, head to our website, kalw.org, click on Audiograph. Thanks for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you've got ideas for where we should record next, tell us. Email us at news@kalw.org. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Lila Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rollins, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Amaranth String Quartet, which is participating in this year's SF Music Day, that's Sunday afternoon, in the newly remodeled Veterans Memorial Building in San Francisco. Details and more local music are at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.